everyone. This is Marion from the Talking Information Center, and this is the Salem News for Tuesday, August 18th. First from Boxford, a former Essex police officer has died after battling cancer. Besides Essex, Boxford police officer Robert Smith, age 36, served in police departments in Topsfield, Wenham, and Middleton before joining the Boxford force in 2021. According to Boxford Police Chief James Ryder, Smith died Thursday, August 13th. He was one of the most well-liked people I've ever met, he said. Ryder said he had known Smith for many years, going back to Smith's time as a student at Mesconomet Regional High School. Rob made sure he reached out to say hello. Rob would often address me and ask how my day was going. Smith was well-liked by his fellow officers as well. It's a testament to Rob that many police departments wanted him, Ryder said. He was one of the nicest, kindest, and most genuine people I've ever met. It will be a loss for everyone who knew him. Essex Police Chief Tom Schmasek said Smith's tenure in Essex began in 2012 and ran to the fall of 2013. He said Smith's legacy was immeasurable. He was one of my best friends. He was one of the most thoughtful and helpful officers anyone could encounter. Everybody that encountered him saw he was always smiling. Even when he left the department, he maintained the friendships he formed while he had with us, said Smasek. According to Facebook posting on Boxford Police page, Smith served with professionalism, integrity, and a genuine commitment to the communities he was entrusted to protect. To those who had the privilege of working alongside him, Rob was much more than a fellow officer, according to the post. His presence, that said, within our department and the relationships he built throughout his career will be remembered for years to come. Smith is survived by his wife, Judy, his children, Jeffrey and Michael, his parents, Bob and Mandy Smith, his brother, Andrew, his sister, Jenny, his nieces and nephews, his in-laws, Sherry O'Reilly and Larry DiLorenzo, his brothers-in-law, Alan, and the late Jeffrey DiLorenzo, and his best friend, Mike Balzi. Visitation hours for Smith are 3 to 7 p.m. on Thursday, August 20th at the Mackey Funeral Home. That's at 128 South Main Street in Middleton. Smith's funeral mass will be at 10:30 a.m. on Friday at St. Rose of Lima Parish, and that's at 12 Park Street in Topsfield. In lieu of flowers, the family is establishing a scholarship in Smith's name for graduating high school students interested in law enforcement. Donations may be sent to the Boxford Police Department, care of the Robert Smith Scholarship Fund, 285 Ipswich Road, Boxford, Mass., 01921. Checks may be payable to the Officer Robert Smith Scholarship Fund. And next from Salem. A $6 million playground is named in honor of Betsy Mary. The Salem YMCA has begun construction on a new rooftop playground space named after late Salem business leader Betsy Mary. The new Betsy Mary playground will be designed to provide a state-of-the-art recreational area to the more than 200 children of all ages and abilities currently enrolled in the YMCA's early learning and school-age programs. Currently, the Salem YMCA has a small, roughly 1,100-square-foot outdoor playground that serves infants, toddlers, and preschoolers. The new rooftop playground will provide a space more than three times the size for school-age children, ranging from 5 to 13 years old, totaling 4,000 square feet. The new space will include a track for tricycles, climbing structures and mounds, a multi-purpose court, shade structures, greenery, gardens, and bathrooms. The $5.5 million project is scheduled to be finished next spring. The YMCA is committing $1 million to the project, with another $1 million coming from a state grant from the Massachusetts Department of Early Education and Care, and the remaining individual donors and foundations. Betsy Mary, who died of leukemia in May of 2022 at the age of 70, was a special education teacher at Salem High School before her career in residential real estate. She managed the Salem Caldwell Banker office for several years and in 2008 established the Mary Fox Realty, with the business success leading her to be featured on This Old House and American Dream TV. Mary also served as the president of the Salem YMCA and a trustee of the Essex Institute before its merger with the Peabody Essex Museum. Mary was also an active member on the boards for Catholic Charities, Historic Salem Incorporated, Hamilton Hall, YMCA of the North Shore, the Salem Partnership, and the Salem Pantry. Kate Mary Walters, Mary's daughter, said her family is honored to support the creation of a rooftop playground in her memory, whose life and legacy was deeply intertwined with the YMCA, the Salem community, and the growth and development of children. My mom was a force of nature, full of energy, optimism, and joy, and a dedicated champion for the YMCA for decades, Walter said. As a former Salem teacher and a longtime community leader, she believed deeply in creating opportunities for children to learn, grow, and thrive. Children who currently have limited outdoor access in downtown Salem will soon have a vibrant place to run, climb, garden, imagine, and connect with one another. Our family is proud to support this project in her memory, and we hope it brings joy, adventure, and opportunity to generations of children for years to come. Salem YMCA Executive Director Chowdhury Lazama said naming the playground is a way to honor Mary's legacy and recognize the influence and support she provided for the YMCA and the greater community. It's such an honor to add this new playground to Betsy's full, rich legacy in Salem, she said. As a board member, friend, and local leader, she was such an incredible advocate for our Y and our mission, and we could not think of a better person to recognize with this naming. Carrying on her commitment to Salem with a truly unique space that will be enjoyed by children in our program. More information about the playground project and donations can be found at northshoreymca.org/salem-rooftop. In Peabody, the Tanner City's free summer concert series wrapped up Sunday evening with hometown favorite, the Lisa Love Experience at Peabody Veterans Memorial High School, followed by fireworks after the show. The extra special display of pyrotechnics was in celebration of America's 250th anniversary. AAA says Northeast gasoline prices are down for a third straight week, but a stalemate in the war between the United States and Iran is keeping the pressure on petroleum markets. Our last front-page story is from the State House reporter. State seeks public input on health care costs. The Healey administration is holding a series of listening sessions to solicit public input on proposed state regulations aimed at lowering health care costs and stabilizing insurance premiums. The Health Care Affordability Working Group's online listening sessions will focus on recommendations from the State Division of Insurance to reduce excessive out-of-network health care costs and reduce premiums in the individual and small group insurance market. Governor Maura Healey said the 30-member working group brings together patients, providers, insurance, and employers to recommend ways to lower health care costs. Health care costs are too high, and they're putting real pressure on families and small businesses across Massachusetts, Healey said. These listening sessions are an important next step in delivering meaningful relief. Beacon Hill officials are seeking ways to blunt the impact of skyrocketing health care premiums that officials say are forcing people to make difficult budget decisions in order to afford medical treatment. Healey, a first-term Democrat, has stepped up her administration's effort to reduce health care costs as she seeks another 4-year term in office. In January, Healey directed the State Division of Insurance to streamline prior authorizations for a wide range of medical procedures, including emergency and urgent care services, primary care, occupational and physical therapy, and some prescription drugs. Healey has also pumped another $250 million into the state-subsidized health system to help offset the impact of now-expired federal tax credits, which have driven up premiums for many care and consumers. The Healey administration has also directed state insurance regulators to pare back proposed health care plan rate hikes sought by commercial insurers this year, rejecting two proposals that call for double-digit increases. Insurers have pointed to hospital and prescription drug costs, specifically the booming demand for the new weight loss and diabetes drugs, which they say are driving much of the rise in medical expenses for many employers. Other factors driving up medical spending include the use of inpatient inpatient and outpatient services, an aging population, and the increased cost of prescription weight loss medicines, the companies have said in their filings to regulators. Healthcare costs are one of the state's biggest expenses, consuming a sizable portion of the annual state budget. The cost of MassHealth, the state's Medicaid program which serves more than 2 million people, accounts for nearly 40% of overall spending. For information on the listening sessions, you can visit the Division of Insurance website. At least 7 people are displaced after a fire in Salem at the home on Putnam Street. They were followed. The fire was a multifamily duplex on Putnam Street on Saturday night, but no injuries were reported. The Salem Fire Department responded to a report of a house fire at 6:57 p.m. on Saturday. Upon arrival, firefighters observed heavy fire coming from the second floor of the 2.5-story duplex at 28-30 Putnam Street. A second alarm was struck due to concerns that the heavy fire could spread to a nearby building. Crews from the Marblehead, Lynn, and Beverly Fire Departments were on the scene to assist. One of the big problems they had with this fire was exposure, said Deputy Fire Chief Peter Schlauben. The house immediately to the left and the building was almost right on top of it, and that was a huge concern. They were able to fend off any damage to the building next door. It was a great stop, he said. Smoke detectors activated and alerted the residents who exited the buildings, and no injuries were reported. A couple on the first floor, a family of 4 or 5 people on the second floor, and one person on the third floor were all displaced due to the damage. Crews were on the scene until 11:30 p.m. searching for any remaining hot spots. Well, we've covered all the local news, so we'll turn now to a couple of AP stories. The first by Joseph Krause of the Associated Press. The 60-day deadline for an Iran peace deal is expiring, and here's where things stand. The deal with the U.S. President Donald Trump signed at Versailles in June set an ambitious 60-day deadline for ending the war with Iran and reaching an accord on its nuclear program. The deadline was Monday, and the two sides are further apart than they were even then. Talks, such as they are, have focused on reopening the Strait of Hormuz and lifting U.S. blockade on Iran, both of which were supposed to have happened under the interim deal. There has been no sign of any compromise on the Strait, or that detailed nuclear talks have even begun. The U.S., meanwhile, has no good options for getting out of the war it started alongside Israel. Acceding to Iran's latest demand would mean giving it control over a critical international waterway that carried a fifth of the world's traded oil and gas before the war, and would be tantamount to admitting defeat. Escalating the deeply unpopular war would further draw down U.S. supplies of advanced missile interceptors, jolt the world economy, and drive up gas prices ahead of U.S. congressional elections. So both sides have dug in, hoping the other will blink first. So far, neither has. In the June deal, known as Memorandum of Understanding, called for a halt to all military operations and set a 60-day deadline for an agreement to permanently end the war and resolve the long-standing dispute over Iran's nuclear activities. It called for the Strait of Hormuz to be reopened, but gave Iran a vaguely defined role in facilitating traffic, leaving open the possibility it could charge fees after the 60-day deadline. Iran has seized on that cause to claim control over the waterway. A week after the deal was signed, Iran began firing on vessels using a route along the coast of Oman, on the other side of the strait, that is overseen by U.S. military and intended to bypass Tehran's control. The U.S. responded by striking Iran, which retaliated by attacking Arab countries hosting American forces like Jordan, Kuwait, and Bahrain. The U.S. canceled waivers issued as part of the deal that had allowed Iran to sell its oil internationally, and Trump restored a blockade of Iran's ports. Each side accused the other of violating the June agreement, of which almost nothing remains. The fighting eventually died down. A related truce in Lebanon between Israel and the Iran-backed Hezbollah has mostly held, even as Israeli troops occupy large areas in the country's south. Lebanon's territorial integrity and sovereignty were to have been ensured under the June deal. Iranian officials say they stopped negotiating with the U.S. in June while acknowledging that messages have been relayed by intermediaries. Trump says the talks have continued, occasionally claiming progress after pulling back from threatening major strikes. Pakistan, which played a key role in brokering the June agreement, noted last week that the deadline was Monday while expressing hope it would be extended. "We are not closing the chapter," Foreign Ministry spokesman Dara Abadi said. "Pakistan is making all-out efforts to bring the two parties to the negotiating table." Earlier this month, Iran issued a list of demands for reopening the strait, including the lifting of American blockade, the withdrawal of U.S. forces from around Iran, and payment of reparations for damage inflicted in the war started by the U.S. and Israel on February 28th. Even then, Iran has said it would control the strait and potentially charge fees, though an agreement it is negotiating with Oman, and that the strait will not go back to being an open toll-free waterway as it was before the war. Iran-backed Houthi rebels in Yemen have meanwhile begun attacking Saudi oil tankers in the Red Sea, threatening another crucial trade route that has been used to relieve some of the pressure from the strait being closed. Trump has rejected Iran's demands, saying it's Tehran that should pay war reparations and claiming the U.S. controls the strait. He appears to be banking on economic pressure in the form of the blockade and long-standing sanctions to bring Iran's rulers to their knees. Iran's economy has been battered by the war and isolation, and inflation has soared. The crisis could stroke renewed anti-government protests like those that were brutally crushed in January. Traffic through the Strait of Hormuz, which rose immediately after the interim deal, is back to a small fraction of what it was before the war. Rising prices of fuel and other goods are expected to climb further the longer this continues, with effects far beyond the Middle East. The clock is ticking for both sides. Next is an op-ed piece by Stephen Carter of the Bloomberg Opinion. It's entitled, "America's Surveillance Problem is Much Bigger Than Flock." "You are being watched," was the tagline that opened every episode of the television series Person of Interest, which ran from 2011 to 2016 and already feels ancient. The conceit of the show was that the good guys, aided by friendly AI, could use information from a sea of cameras and microphones to stop crimes before they happened. That fictional world comes to mind in light of the controversy surrounding Flock Safety, a company that has installed some 120,000 cameras in cities and towns across the United States. Flock's automatic license plate recognition system identifies passing cars and stores their identifying details, make, model, a Mets bumper sticker, a cracked rear window, in a searchable database. The utility to law enforcement is pretty obvious. But after years of strong growth, the company is facing serious backlash. Dozens of jurisdictions have canceled their contracts with Flock since 2025. Some are angry that Flock has been used for immigration enforcement. Others point to examples of law enforcement officers abusing the system. The ACLU has published a model resolution that city governments can use to end their relationship with Flock. Then there's DeFlock, a crowdsourced effort to map the locations of as many license plate readers as possible. And back in February, Amazon publicly canceled a plan to link its Ring cameras with Flock systems. My libertarian hat is always warmed when there are signs, however faint, that the future might contain less surveillance rather than more. And critics of Flock's misuse are right to be alarmed. But Flock is only part of a much bigger problem. The more fundamental mistake was letting surveillance become a ubiquitous part of American life. It's hard to imagine now, but in the 19th century, when cameras were young, it was considered discourteous to take a person's picture without permission. Now, once we've exited our homes, our images are being recorded constantly. In cities and suburbs, and increasingly rural areas, cameras along the road are accepted as a fact of life. That's a problem. In a democracy, we ought to have the right to simply to privacy, but to anonymity, to go to the ordinary occupations of daily life without being tracked or surveilled. To be seen by real people, fellow walkers, fellow drivers, is one thing. To be constantly recorded is something else entirely. It's almost funny to see so many public officials who now profess to having had no idea that installing cameras all over our cities and towns would lead to mass surveillance. The cameras are mass surveillance. They capture images, which the AI then helpfully labels, and surprise, surprise, law enforcement suddenly wants to sift through those images. That's the heart of the problem. A traffic camera might seem innocuous, a device to discourage running red lights. A security camera up on the light pole might seem insignificant, a tool for fighting crime. A license plate reader might seem just a way of keeping track of cars in case a villain happens along. But continue enough bits of data, and the government can create what the Supreme Court condemned just this past June in its decision restricting the use of geofencing, a virtual panopticon which used to scrutinize its citizens' activities. Privacy advocates are calling for tighter controls before authorities can query Flock's database, perhaps even a warrant requirement. Flock itself now audits law enforcement requests, and some of the officers who have been arrested for misusing it were, the company says, caught through its efforts. But no government will ever fully resist the temptation to mine whatever data is gathered, and in the long run, the Fourth Amendment will never keep up with technology. The machine is everywhere, Harold Finch of Person of Interest told his associate, John Reese, way back in the horse and buggy area of 2011. Watch us with 10,000 eyes, listening with a million ears. The capital M referred to a particular AI system which Finch had designed. But the eyes and ears didn't belong to the machine. They were just the background sounds and images that are constantly being recorded. The machine was fiction. The constant watching and listening are real. That's why the true issue isn't just Flock, it isn't ICE or a few bad cops. The problem is the government's growing obsession with keeping a constant eye on those it exists to serve. And another op-ed piece from Richard McGowan from The View. Richard McGowan has a doctorate of philosophy and an adjunct scholar at the Indiana Policy Review Foundation. He's taught philosophy and ethics cores for more than 40 years, most recently at Butler University. And he writes, "Universities' academic choices, policies discourage men." He said, "When I taught business ethics at Butler University, 1993 to 2018, the student body was consistently over 60% women, once hitting over 65%. Inasmuch as any applied ethics course must deal with the real-world data, the data were given to students when we addressed affirmative action policies. That triggered several of my male students to visit my office, and offer me stories about how they were treated at Butler. I made sure they knew that, in the disparity, Butler was not unique, and that the hostility they said they felt was not isolated to Butler, that some schools had female professors who barred men from taking their courses. The young men felt marginalized. If colleges are to be a success, young men have to feel welcome on the campus and in class. Again, Butler is not unique." Campuses across America have women's studies programs and women's centers with no analog for men. It is it any wonder that Chronicle of Higher Education has articles in the precipitous decline of males attending schools of higher education? The patent was established in the early 1980s, for it's been that long ago that female undergrads outnumbered men, with institutions showing little or no regard for disparities that favor women. As well, the cultural pattern of snubbing boys and men occurred in the 80s. Sarah Ruddick's maternal thinking stated that anyone who took care of their children was a mother, no matter what the sex, thereby insulting male caregivers. Andrea Dworkin's comment that any woman who has given birth has been raped twice, once at conception and then at birth of the child, was denigrating to both men and women. The kind of toxicity those two feminists showed characterized much of popular culture and was tolerated by institutions of higher education. Shortly before I retired, a committee was formed to implement a social justice component in the curriculum. My ethics course, which included a critical appraisal of various positions on distributive justice, did not qualify to satisfy the requirement. The committee assigned to design the social justice component was composed of 9 women and 2 men, none of whom had an advanced degree in philosophy, the discipline where matters of justice are critically appraised. As a side note, the widely used and well-respected Stanford Encyclopedia has no entry for social justice, nor does it have an entry for equity, inasmuch as those terms presume a preferred position on distributive justice. That encyclopedia treats the matter of justice philosophically as an open question. Thus, it's no surprise to me that men are not attending college. When we discussed affirmative action in class, I pointed out that people who are excluded lose incentive to try to get a job or a position. It's an argument for affirmative action on behalf of the excluded. Inasmuch as boys and men are not the preferred sex, or perhaps more accurately, are the wrong sex, per enrollment numbers and per affirmative action policy, they can be expected to show less interest in college. Schools should work harder at removing toxic behavior regarding all groups, even men. Until that happens, the national disparity regarding the sexes will continue. It's currently 59% female undergraduates and 41% males, growing over the past several years. The graduate population is even more dramatic. 39% of enrolled graduate students are male, 61% are female. This according to Education Data Initiative. It will be a better day when colleges and universities bring students who felt excluded from higher education back into the fold. These days, that means men. And we'll end today's reading with some history trivia. On this date, in 1914, President Woodrow Wilson issued his Proclamation of Neutrality, aimed at keeping the United States out of World War I. And in 1920, the 19th Amendment to the Constitution, guaranteeing American women's right to vote, was ratified as Tennessee became the 36th state to approve it. Backtrack a little bit, but in 1590, on this day, John White, the governor of the Roanoke Island Colony, present-day North Carolina, returned to Roanoke after nearly 3 years abroad, only to find the settlement deserted. The fate of the lost colony still remains a mystery to this day. In 1963, James Meredith became the first black student to graduate from the University of Mississippi. In 1969, the Woodstock Music and Art Fair in Bethel, New York, wound to a close after 3 days and nights with a mid-morning set by Jimi Hendrix. In 1983, Hurricane Alicia slammed into Texas coast, leaving 21 dead and causing more than $1 billion worth of damage. And in 2005, a judge in Wichita, Kansas, sentenced BTK serial killer Dennis Rader to 10 consecutive life terms, the maximum the law would allow. And in 2014, Missouri Governor Jay Nixon ordered the National Guard to Ferguson, a suburb of St. Louis, in convulsed by protests over the fatal shooting of a black 18-year-old named Michael Brown. And lastly, in 2023, a former neonatal nurse in a British hospital was found guilty of murdering 7 babies and trying to kill 6 others over a year-long campaign of deception as she preyed on the vulnerabilities of sick newborns. Days later, Lucy Letby was sentenced to life in prison with no chance of parole. Well, that's a wrap for today's reading of the Salem News. Thank you so much for listening, ladies and gentlemen. Hope you all have a great day.